Greetings and welcome to this week's episode of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. My guest for this week's episode is Marik Hazan, and he is from Tabula Rasa Ventures, and we are discussing Tabula Rasa Ventures and psychedelic healthcare that Marik kind of worked at the forefront of integrating healthcare with access, with finances and product development. And I know it's a kind of a controversial subject for a lot of people who are wary about psychedelic healthcare and the medicalizing of psychedelic use. But I think it's an important part of the conversation, and I'm happy to have Marik on. I am actually out of town while this is going out into the world, so I'm recording this episode about a week early prior to its release. So if you have made a contribution in support of the podcast over this past week or so, I will thank you when I get back home and do the next episode of the podcast. But of course, if you would like to support this podcast, you can stop by my personal webpage at martinbald.net, use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, or use the link over to my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/martinwball, and sign up at the level that is comfortable for you, everywhere from $1 a month up to $100 a month, which of course at the top level gets you a 1-hour consultation with me monthly, as well as access and gifts and other cool stuff like that. And of course, if you sign up at the $20 a month level and above, that gets you access to the full back catalog of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, which is exclusively available over at my Patreon page. As I like to mention, of course, I am available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations to help you integrate your entheogenic experience. If you'd like to set up a consultation with me, shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com or stop by at www.nondualentheogenicintegration.com for more details. Of course, next week we will have the next chapter from my book, A Sleep Story, An Unintentional Exploration of the Altered States of Being Awake. And of course, that was last week we started off that book, and that's what we're going to be sharing in between interviews for the next few months here on the podcast. Of course, there are more great interviews coming your way. I have a lot of potential guests lined up. Still have two more interviews that are already recorded and just waiting to come out here on the podcast. So lots more to come this year of 2023 here on the Entheogenic Evolution. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. And I'm going to go ahead and sign off. Let's get into the conversation with Marik. I hope you enjoy. Okay, well, today I am welcoming on to the Entheogenic Evolution podcast is Marik Hazan. And he comes to me by way of an email introduction that he is working in psychedelic venture capital. He is presented at Davos about psychedelic businesses and healthcare, and runs, according to the website, says world's largest psychedelic conference of Psyched, which I have to admit I haven't heard of. So sorry, haven't heard of that one. And also the CEO of Energia Holdings. So I think we've got a lot of interesting things to talk about today, Marik. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Martin. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. So I always like to start by, especially if it's somebody that maybe my audience has never heard of before, doesn't know, kind of like to get to know the person. So that's where we're going to start today. So Marik, please just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, aside from all the businesses and conferences and the healthcare and all of that, but we want to get to know you a little bit. And the question I always ask everyone is, well, what got you into psychedelics in the area that you are in? What sparked that interest and passion?
Definitely. Yeah. So I'll start a little bit of like who I am as a human being, and then we'll get to psychedelics and how I found myself there. But, yeah, so I was born outside the country. I was born in the Crimea, which is basically, for those who don't know, a disputed region, peninsula off of Ukraine. Came over in the early 90s with my family through a refugee program and grew up in basically a community for refugees from the same region in upstate New York and Rochester, where I currently am waiting to celebrate Thanksgiving in the next couple of days. Growing up here, there was also a lot of other immigrant and refugee families, and so a lot of my childhood and into kind of my adult life was spent around folks who are just from all over the world, lots of different socioeconomic backgrounds, lots of different religious backgrounds, different views on different things. And I also have a very kind of like bifurcated, if that's the right word, family of, I would say that the my mom's side of the family is much more kind of traditional medicine and healthcare and approaches to the world, much more kind of grinding in the system, whereas my dad's side of the family is much more kind of alternative medicine and alternative ways of life. And so I think from a young age, I was just always kind of in the mix of a lot of different opinions and perspectives colliding. And so when I went to college, I studied computer engineering, was kind of like fulfilling some immigrant karma there, even though I'm much more a poet than a quant, went through that program and found myself scrapping all of my PhD applications for engineering programs my senior year, actually like the summer right before my senior year of college started, and kind of having a realization that I really should be doing something else, and felt that business school would be a good place for me to kind of like experiment and see where I should go next. So scrapped those applications, went to business school, and that's really where I started transitioning from engineering to what I call today counterculture advocacy. And I had been part of various advocacy movements from a young age. I didn't even realize that that's what I was doing just because that's kind of like what I knew and it was just fun for me, but had contributed to the disability rights movement, the interfaith advocacy movement, and a couple others in my childhood and through kind of my teenage years and into my early 20s. But when I started business school, kind of came across counterculture lifestyles that I also felt were not necessarily getting the support they needed in terms of the realm of advocacy. So the first movement that I contributed to was the sex worker rights movement. Another movement I contributed to was the decentralized governance movement. So a lot of the infrastructure of DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, was some of what I was chipping away at years back. And so it was all of these kind of like structured anarchy, sex workers' rights. There was definitely kind of psychedelic-minded folks in a lot of these different spaces. And I had just a deep curiosity of, you know, how can we actually support a lot of these movements, these movers, shakers, and really be able to help the world advance in a way that was maybe difficult because culture was changing at different rates in different communities. Off the back of all of that, in around 2018, I had had several psychedelic experiences, and at one point kind of saw that the psychedelic movement felt like it was about to take a very similar turn as I had seen many other movements take, especially when capital started flowing in. And what that really was especially, you know, you could see it in the sex worker rights movement play out when I was there. You know, billions of dollars of capital flowed in. There was kind of the advent of advertising within the adult industry in the early 2000s as well. And that ended up causing a lot of very serious rifts within the sex worker rights movement. It created dynamics where performers weren't as well compensated. It created dynamics where agents, production studios, and distributors had significantly more leverage. And it created dynamics where nonprofits that were behind a lot of the protections for sex workers all of a sudden had to open up their boards to individuals who had significant pools of capital at their disposal to be able to kind of keep themselves going and keep themselves alive as capital shifted from nonprofits to for-profits in the space. And kind of seeing all of those changes and realizing that this was very likely going to happen in the psychedelic space as well. There were only, you know, 3-4 companies at the time. I think it was like Atai, Compass, Elusis were really the only ones. I don't think MindMed had even really started then. But I had just seen that, you know, some of these companies are raising, you know, tens of millions of dollars. There's about to be a pretty significant boom in a psychedelic industry of sorts and billions of dollars of capital flowing into here. So for me, there was this, you know, question, how do we facilitate a smoother transition from a space that was built on nonprofits and advocacy groups to a space that actually had for-profit activity? And that's kind of where a lot of my work began and how I kind of came into working full-time in the psychedelic space is really trying to find the answer to that question.
Okay. Wow. Well, thank you for the introduction there. And I'm going to invite you to back up to the beginning for just a minute here, because I just want to ask you a few more questions sort of about your origin. And thank you for sharing that you are part of a immigrant refugee family. I think that that's a very interesting part of your story. And I was even very curious, you know, when I saw your name, Mari Kazan, that to me it sounded like a Persian name. So I was thinking, oh, maybe it's from somewhere in that part of the world. But that, so it doesn't sound like a Crimean, I mean, it doesn't sound like a Russian language name. So does your family also have roots going back further into Persia and in that area?
Yeah, so actually, oftentimes people believe that it's a Middle Eastern name because Hazan, especially, is typically mixed up with Hassan. So Hassan in Arabic, I believe, means handsome, but Hazan actually means like the cantor, the person who sings in ceremony and in religious ceremony in the Jewish tradition. So they oftentimes get mixed up. So Hazan is actually a Jewish name. It's kind of the singer of ceremony. In Jewish tradition. Marik, Marik is like basically the diminutive form of Mark, which is a name of Greek origin. But in the former Soviet Union, because Jews were persecuted, at least this is kind of the narrative that I've heard passed down from my grandparents and parents, is because there was persecution of Jews in those regions, oftentimes the diminutive form of names was actually used almost as a code name for Jewish families to be able to communicate that a child is Jewish within their family context, but have a Grecian name to be able to be in the outside world. So Mark is actually my legal name, Mark Kazanov. And as the Crimean conflict was breaking out in 2015, I decided to kind of switch my name. 2014-2015 was kind of like in a more rebellious phase, feeling a lot of animosity towards everything that was happening with the Russian invasion, and decided to redirect. But Marik is like what my community calls me. It's what my family calls me. It's what I was called back when we were in the Soviet Union in kind of closed quarters, even if Mark was my public facing name. And then Hazan is the root of Hazanov, Kazanov. And removing the OV for me was kind of a process of like taking that Russian root out of it. So that's, maybe more complexity than was asked for, but that's kind of the whole story.
No, well, that's really fascinating, actually, and I enjoy that you have so much to share just about the name itself and sort of its relationship to culture, religion, politics, society. And I think it's far more interesting, in the psychedelic world, there are a lot of people who kind of give themselves their own name, I'm going to be so-and-so Moonfeather or right. Whatever. So it's interesting to hear all of this personal and family history that's sort of embedded within your name and how you chose it as sort of a social statement and mm-hmm. as an expression of your own identity in a way that is not just quote unquote completely made up, right? That it's actually tying into various roots that you're making a statement by making these choices. So I think that's just fascinating. So thank you for sharing about that.
Yeah, thank you for asking. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I deal with people from all around the world on a daily or weekly basis. And I actually taught English for international students, among other things, for a variety of years. So I've always enjoyed, meeting people from around the world and just getting little snippets of people's backgrounds and asking them about their names and their families and things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So where should we start then? So we've got a little bit of your background. And obviously, as you've said, the public acceptance of, particularly when we're talking about like psychedelic healthcare, it's changing really, really rapidly. You're probably aware that, I'm here in Oregon and we're coming up on 2023, and that is the beginning of the actual access to the psilocybin assisted services program. And so I know there's a lot of people right here in Southern Oregon. They're going to be opening up psilocybin centers and retreat centers, and this is going to be happening. And it's the kind of thing when I moved here in 2007, it was just a dream. Like maybe this will happen someday way down the road, but it seems to be happening very, very quickly. And as you say, there's a lot of money involved. There's a lot of people that are investing. There's a lot of discussion and even controversy within the quote unquote psychedelic community about how money should be involved or not be involved. Like even here with the psilocybin services program, there are a number of people who, we could say were members of the psychedelic community in Oregon who were against it. And they didn't want it because it's going to turn it into a business and we want to keep it sacred or we want to keep it personal. And I'm the kind of person that I'm interested in any kind of change that positively benefits people. And like here in Oregon, we have a disastrous record with mental health care. It's shit in Oregon.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people on the positive side of the psilocybin program are saying like, yeah, this we need not only this, but we need more access to novel treatments for psychedelics
right. because the healthcare realm needs it. So it's a really rapidly changing ecosystem and landscape. And it sounds like you're one of the people who is positioning themselves sort of at the forefront of this, the nexus between the money and the developing businesses themselves. So yeah, let's get into Tabula Rasa Ventures and explain it, especially for the lay persons like myself. Sometimes I say here on the podcast, like I'm just at this point, I used to be a university professor, but I got laid off. So I'm a completely 100% self-employed person. I'm not a big finance person. I've never been involved in the world of big finance. And, you know, I'm lucky to pay my bills, you know, so that's where I am in the world. Yep. So yeah, tell us about it. And also kind of with that idea that there are people in this psychedelic world, they're like, oh, don't even talk about money. It's so evil. Mm-hmm. You know, yep. Not to put too much pressure on you or anything.
Definitely. Yeah. No, it's really fascinating. I think, you know, it's very easy to get into some super interesting, like, philosophical conversations about, yeah, money in general or capital or capitalism. And you have to, like, we have these conversations on a very regular basis. And I think that anyone who is taking more of a multi-stakeholder approach to building up the psychedelic ecosystem, I think that they are they're having these conversations on a regular basis. But to kind of lay some foundations and some groundwork, so basically venture capital, for those who don't know, is in I guess you could call it an industry or a field of finance where what you're really trying to do is you're trying to identify really small companies, really early stage companies that are just basically getting started, that you believe are going to grow and have, you know, outsized impact in the world in some way. And oftentimes you're meeting these entrepreneurs in their first couple years of building a company or an organization of some sort. And what you're basically saying to that company is, listen, like, we believe in what you're building. We think that you're going to grow significantly and really have impact in the world in a really big way. We want to give you a portion, some capital, and that can range, you know, from $10,000 to millions of dollars, depending on the venture capital firm, depending on who's investing and the opportunity itself. And we'll give you this amount of money today for a portion of your company. And let's say that, you know, that company is, you know, worth $100,000 today, or, you know, a couple million dollars today, then maybe you're buying only 10% of that company, just a small chunk of that company. But over 10 years of time, that company might go from being $1 million or a couple million dollars in value to being $100 million or $500 million or billions of dollars in value, in the value that it's also creating for people in the world. And so your 10% automatically becomes much more valuable, because instead of owning 10% of a $1 million company, which is, you know, $100,000 if you do the quick math, you know, 10% of a $1 billion company is $100 million. And so, you know, from that calculation, going from 100,000 to 100 million is a very, you know, humongous growth in capital. And typically where that money comes from is from a lot of different places. That capital can come from angel investors who are just individuals who have capital. Maybe they've exited their own company. Maybe they've made money. It can come from governments. It can come from nonprofit organizations. Nonprofit organizations also have to invest. So they need to grow their pool of capital so that they can actually provide greater services to people. So every nonprofit organization that's a serious organization has also an investing team that places their capital, their core funds, into investments to be able to grow their pool of capital so they can provide more services. And so really the whole world and how it operates is mainly on this foundation of capital. And so whether it's a nonprofit organization, a government, a wealthy individual, they need to place their money somewhere so that over time that they can grow it. And so what we provide is the service of being able to take that money for whatever type of organization or individual it is and saying, listen, there's a really large opportunity here. We see that there's going to be a lot of companies that get started in the psychedelic space that are rolling out psychedelic therapeutics in some fashion, and we see them growing significantly over these next 10 years. If you place your capital here, then your capital is going to grow you know, X amount over this many years. And that's why you should trust us to be able to do this, because we're also experts in this space. We know the policymakers and the therapists and the Indigenous community members and the other entrepreneurs, et cetera. And we see this space in a much more holistic way. We understand how it's going to evolve and also the pitfalls to avoid so that your money doesn't go down the drain by investing into things that ultimately can't succeed. So that's kind of the general gist and kind of how it applies, I guess, to the psychedelic space there. But I know that that opens up a door to a million more conversations.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we can kind of jump on some of the things you just mentioned here towards the end. In particular, one that stood out that you mentioned was Indigenous communities. And that seems to be kind of a sticking point for a lot of people around sort of the medicalization of psychedelics and investment in psychedelics on the money side of talking about. But what about the Indigenous communities? And it's, I think it's a really valid question, but it's also, sometimes I think it might be a little bit overplayed in the sense, like, again, here in Oregon, we have people talking about, well, what about the Indigenous communities when it comes to psilocybin? And historically, there were no Indigenous cultures in Oregon that used psilocybin mushrooms. So, it, you know, there are now, like in a local community not too far from where I am here in Ashland, there's Williams, Oregon, and it's a place where a Native American church is very active with the use of peyote, which, again, there were no historical Indigenous tribes in Oregon that ever used peyote. They're also doing a lot of ayahuasca out there, and also here in Ashland, and this is a place where there were no Indigenous people who were using ayahuasca. And then there's also a lot of mushroom ceremonies, and as I've already mentioned, there were no Indigenous cultures that used psilocybin mushrooms. There were some cultures that used Amanita mushrooms, which is a totally different mushroom, completely different range of psychedelic experience. So I'm just wondering, so you mentioned these different groups of like the healthcare providers, Indigenous voices, the people who are, I guess we could say, on the non-money side of things, who are invested in how things develop. So I'm curious, like, what kinds of relationships or communications do you have in these areas?
Yeah. So we have many different relationships with many different stakeholders within this space. There's actually a pretty good book called Conscious Capital or Conscious Capitalism, I've forgotten, but John Mackey, the individual who founded Whole Foods and built it up before it was sold to Amazon, wrote this book and really talks a lot about multi-stakeholder alignment. A lot of, you know, what Whole Foods did, you know, I think it's actually a really great book for people to dip their toe into the world of you know, what conscious capital can actually look like and be able to at least have a little bit more of a solid foundation in having these conversations, if they're actually interested in having productive conversations of what capital can do and what it can't do and where it hurts and where it helps, because I think it is very nuanced and complex. So that could be a good place for folks to start. But really, the idea of multi-stakeholder alignment is actually, you know, you can't build long-term sustainable businesses without understanding the needs of every stakeholder involved in a system. So it's not possible. Basically, the theory is that unless you understand the needs of the Indigenous community members, for instance, you can't actually build a sustainable business for the long run, because if you're building something without that stakeholder involved, you're going to lose trust from the community, and eventually that will turn against you and your business, and your customers won't trust you. And that's something that we're seeing happen with Amazon and Facebook, et cetera, who didn't take multi-stakeholder alignment seriously. Whereas companies like Whole Foods, again, up until the sale to Amazon, had built significant loyalty over decades of time with many different stakeholders, including advocacy groups, because they were taking into account those opinions and had built a significant loyalty and had many actually very specific, very interesting, what would be the term, like pieces of infrastructure within their company to prevent kind of corporate greed and to prevent, just exploitation of both customers and company resources. You know, I think on the topic of Indigenous community members, for instance, it definitely is tricky. It's very complex. There's, you know, nothing that is simple when like these worlds are colliding. I do think, though, that there's, you know, really big questions to ask here, though, not only on the side of capital, but also on the side of advocacy or impact initiatives when it comes to Indigenous communities, because I actually think that the world of venture will not affect, from my perspective, not affect even close to as much of the lives of Indigenous community members as the nonprofit initiatives, as the community efforts, as the impact efforts. A venture capital firm is looking for something that can 1,000x basically a company that can basically 1,000x an investment. And that is not going to be clinics typically. That's not going to be any sort of first generation psychedelic molecules because they're all open. You can't really patent anything. So it's not going to really be psilocybin. It's not really going to be peyote. It's not going to be ayahuasca. It's not going to be these things. Really, it's looking, you know, venture is looking for technology companies that can scale really quickly. It's looking for really important pieces of infrastructure, for instance, insurance reimbursement models for psychedelic-assisted therapy. It's looking for really novel innovation on the drug development side. So how do you take MDMA and how do you alter that molecule to be able to eliminate the crash the next day? Those are the types of things that venture is looking for, which oftentimes are much more removed from kind of grassroots efforts or small business ecosystem. What does have, you know, significant impact on the lives of Indigenous community members, advocacy groups, patient populations, I think is much more things like nonprofits. So, you know, for instance, when we look at COVID taking place, you know, I've lived in the Peruvian Amazon. I've worked with, you know, the Shipibo. I know many of the people who run different organizations down there. And one of the things that happened is that a lot of the nonprofit infrastructure that was built out there, a lot of the political infrastructure that was built out there, actually had the problem of being very poor when it came to capital management. They were very irresponsible with regards to how they thought about money because they also came with the same sentiment of, you know, money corrupts, money is evil, we need to give all of our money to, you know, people and to the community. Well, when COVID happened, because nonprofits had this mentality and this kind of antagonism towards capital, all of a sudden the tourism industry stops. There's no additional capital. There's been kind of this Charity Inc. sort of system that's been built where Indigenous communities now rely on these nonprofits. And all of a sudden, those nonprofits don't have cash reserves to be able to support any of these Indigenous communities. And so, you know, this idea of not being in alignment with capital and being nuanced and thoughtful about it, I actually think is really hurting people. Really hurting people on the ground in a very significant way, even more so than, you know, venture capital or the world of investment. Now, that's not to say that like the world of investment and for-profit capitalism isn't extremely harmful in a lot of ways to the end consumer customer. And we can get into that and talk about that. And there's a lot of, you know, different ideas that I think need to be discussed there too. But I think that there's, you know, a very serious need right now for there to be significantly more individuals who are extremely interested and excited in the field of logistical planning and resource allocation on the ground, working with Indigenous communities, working with advocacy groups, working with the end patients who are going to benefit most with but most from these medicines. And if that doesn't happen, that's what's going to, I believe, hurt people the most. And so in our impact efforts, we also have a foundation. In our impact efforts, we're actually focused mostly on those types of projects that really move the needle on building awareness for some of these things, as well as supporting specific research initiatives that help open up access, for instance, like we're working with Howard University right now to focus on a center for collective healing. So how do we begin to bring collective healing frameworks in the group format into not only psychedelic therapy, but also into any sort of group therapy so that we can actually lower economic costs for the end patient. So like that's of particular interest to us and something that we think really needs to be figured out to be able to curb some of the negative ramifications of capital flowing into the space as well at a very rapid rate. So anyway, many more things that we can talk about there, but just like a few snippets.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate sort of the overview that you're able to provide around this issue and, you know, speak to the importance of money and investment if we really do want to create some kind of meaningful social change and sustainable systems, that there does need to be money involved and it has to be a lot more than just good feelings and good intentions. You know, like just a couple things that come to mind for me. You know, I lived on a Native American reservation in the United States in the Southwest. And, you know, a lot of that it's really like the third world. I mean, people often don't have running water. They might not have electricity. They don't have access to healthcare. And like when I was there, and I do think this is an important issue, so I don't want to diminish it. But the elder medicine man that I lived with, one of his favorite sports teams was the Redskins. And, you know, I asked him, like, well, how do you feel about the name? Because, you know, that's a movement. Like, people want to change the name. It's about representation, and it's about, you know, indigenous voices and representation in the media and in sports. And he was like, look, I don't give a shit. I don't care that they're called the Redskins. I actually like it because it makes me feel like there's some kind of representation there. I said, but, you know, we need a new hospital here. We need a new school. We need teachers. So for him, it actually was like kind of that it's the investment issue that actually we're more concerned about. And then also there was corruption in the tribal government on the reservation and, you know, mismanagement of funds, kind of what you're talking about as well. And so I do think that there's an extreme value in not just looking at the quote unquote sort of feel good symbolic things, which I think are important, but I think a lot of people stop there. And I think part of it is sort of that idea that, oh, well, I don't want to be involved in money because it's bad, but actually we do need investments in these communities. We do need investments and proper management of funds, and certainly not, you know, the corruption or they're just paying out of family members or whatever. So I think it's a really important topic. And I think that everybody, especially people who get really kind of hot around the issue of money, I think it'd be best for them to kind of step back and cool down a little bit and listen to a voice like yourself that really is working this interface between all these different communities and looking at what is really needed and what's actually going to benefit people. So I think that that's a great way to approach it. Now, in terms of Tabula Rasa Ventures itself, how do all these elements interface within the company itself? Okay, so what I was asking when we just got the boot from the internet there was, how do all these voices and these different stakeholders, how do they interface through the through Tabula Rasa itself? Because, you know, just looking at the website, obviously we have founding partners, we have lots of advisors, we have contributors and volunteers. So what are the roles that people play in facilitating these exchanges and conversations between these different areas of stakeholders when it comes to the medicalization of psychedelic healthcare?
Yeah. So on the Tabula Rasa front, Tabula Rasa is mostly focused on investment in the psychedelic sector. I would say like the energy ecosystem, which is kind of what we've built. So there's like there's a holding company called Energia. There's a foundation called the Energia Foundation. And so within the Energia ecosystem, there's a lot of different individuals who collaborate and intersect to be able to have these types of conversations. I would say that for Tabula Rasa, again, it's really specifically focused on investment within the psychedelic sector. And a lot of how we approach investment is focused on more of an impact investing approach. So how do we have companies register as public benefit corporations in the early stages? How do we have founders sign kind of giving pledges to be able to donate a portion of their proceeds to whether that's Indigenous community members, other nonprofit initiatives, impact initiatives, things like that? How do we help early stage companies build more sustainable management teams that are, you know, don't necessarily have maybe, I don't know if toxic is the right word, but maybe ineffective, toxic, corrupt governance dynamics, and also just focusing on other kind of like ESG environment, like sustainability kind of goals. So that's kind of on the investment side. On the foundation side, a lot of what we try to do is a lot of what I did in kind of my time in advocacy was thinking and talking about what I call D2O advocacy, which is demonstration to organization advocacy. So what does that mean? Demonstration to organization. So when you look at the history of most movements, what you'll typically find is that there's this disagreement today. Like, do protests and do demonstrations actually work? Do they actually do anything? And when you look at the history of different movements, what you find is that the movements themselves definitely cause a stir in some way. Whether it's productive or not is a really big question, because even if it pulls attention towards something, oftentimes it creates polarization. And that polarization, you know, oftentimes lasts for decades and actually just kind of keeps the pendulum swinging back and forth. So, you know, you go to somewhere like rural Alabama today, the polarization that was caused by the civil rights movement in the 60s, you know, has people still saying, oh, like, who is this Martin Luther King, et cetera, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean that the civil rights movement wasn't extremely important to the history of America, but it also does mean that there's polarization that's created that has long-lasting effects across the globe or across the country. And so really what is most fascinating to me is that there's also not just the power of protests and demonstrations to be able to cause some sort of bring attention to a specific issue. But the other thing that is extremely essential to the success of movements that happens as a result of demonstrations and protest type of activities is actually the collisions that happen between thought leaders at those types of events and at those types of initiatives. And once those individuals collide with one another, and when they build organizations together that can stand the test of time and live beyond the activists themselves, like, for instance, the NAACP, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, et cetera, that's where you actually get the most change within society, is organizational change over decades of time pushing for those things. And so a lot of what we try to do on the foundation side is, how do we actually get all these stakeholders that I mentioned to collide more often? And how do we get them to collide in ways that are extremely important and consequential? So this year, for instance, we brought many different stakeholders from the space, policymakers, therapists, doctors, researchers, indigenous community members, investors, entrepreneurs, all to speak at Davos, which is kind of held in parallel with the World Economic Forum. So a lot of people also, you know, if people are villainizing capital, they're probably villainizing the World Economic Forum in one way or another. But for those who don't necessarily know what the World Economic Forum is, it's, you know, some people consider it the closest thing to the world's Illuminati. But in many ways, you can look at it as, you know, many of the world's biggest politicians and financiers coming together to be able to have discussions around, you know, what they consider sustainability or progress for the world. And there's a lot of controversy around this event, but it really is a place where many of the world's most important leaders are coming together for 5 days of time to be able to have these conversations. And so when we hosted in May this first ever Psychedelics House of Davos, we brought all of these stakeholders together to be able to educate many of these world leaders on psychedelics, indigenous plant medicines, psychedelic therapeutics, overall, you know, and everything from, you know, the like molecular structure and the research that comes from that to integration, preparation, the actual psychedelic experience, to music and psychedelic therapy. So all of these different topics that are, you know, held near and dear to the hearts of the people who work in this space and who contribute to it. So for the foundation, we try to really bring people together and allow for those individuals to collide and have demonstrations that really try to reduce polarization instead of amplifying it, but also allow for more collisions to happen, kind of facilitating this demonstration to organization type of advocacy, this D2O type of advocacy that can then lead to organizations that over the next few decades will blossom as a result of, you know, someone from the Peruvian Amazon colliding with someone from Compass Pathways, them being able to be in conversation with one another and possibly find more room for resonance and, you know, possibly building things together, as unlikely as that might sound to people who believe that those worlds are completely antagonistic towards one another.
Yeah, well, I'm really fascinated by these presentations that were given at Davos. And I'm wondering if maybe you have just a few anecdotes of people minds getting opened or changed or seeing things in a new light. I mean, again, this is something that's like so far removed from my own experience of like being in a crowd like that. Mm-hmm. It's even hard to imagine, like, what did people think? How did they react? What did they get excited about? Or where was the pushback? And so I'm just curious if you have any anecdotes that could kind of highlight some of these issues for us.
Well, yeah, like the week started out in a very interesting way. Basically, people were you know, coming to our house with one of two perspectives. Either they were saying, like, is this a concern to WEF and do we need to close down this house because there are drugs here and something illicit happening? Or it was people coming to our house being like, hey, can we buy drugs here? So those were kind of like the only two perspectives that most people at the beginning of the week had when they were coming into the space. Now, as the week went on, we basically became the most popular house in Davos this past May because the level of quality of what we brought there was just extremely high. And so what we got kind of the Davos community to begin really having conversations with us about is, you know, not only the psychedelic assisted therapy work, but what does it actually look like to roll out psychedelic assisted therapy in the Middle East, for instance? You know, we have the health ministers of Saudi Arabia coming to us and talking to us about what does it look like to roll out psychedelic assisted therapy. Personally had a conversation with John Kerry about the psychedelic House of Davos and, you know, psychedelic therapeutics within the United States, which I'm sure had many ripple effects on kind of a lot of the things that are happening today. With kind of federal initiatives around psychedelics. So there were many interesting conversations that were able to be had there with these kind of like global leaders and stakeholders. And for the most part, people there were really open. They were really interested. They wanted to understand. They wanted to learn. We had really beautiful moments of, you know, being in circles with people who are, you know, just human beings and, you know, have lost a child to suicide or have, you know, really gone through an extreme trauma themselves, either in their childhood or their adult life, and not being able to find solutions for themselves, coming and finding that perhaps psychedelic assisted therapy was the path forward for them. And that was just a really beautiful, beautiful process to be able to engage in and to see the whole psychedelics community, all of these different stakeholders come together to be able to push that forward. And I won't name names because there's kind of like a connotation that, you know, people having their minds changed was maybe they were coming from a more like less open-minded place. But what I will say is that I think that regardless of whether they were from the for-profit or nonprofit space, you know, the advocacy or, you know, the commercialization side of things, every single person who was there had a shift in their perspective walking out of there that I was, you know, in our belief was more complex, nuanced, and holistic towards this space after we had kind of, you know, brought everyone together like that and forced them to literally live together for, you know, a week of time in this very high stakes sort of situation. So yeah.
Wow, that sounds really impressive. Are you planning on doing this again? Is this going to be like a regular yearly activity at Davos?
Yeah. So this year at Davos, we're going to be doing something much smaller. We're going to be doing a House of Health and Healing. Our goal over the next 10 years now with specifically Davos is, you know, instead of allowing for psychedelics to remain siloed, we're trying to get on course to be able to have psychedelics basically not be able for the WEF to have a conversation around health without also having a conversation around psychedelics. And so that's kind of our strategy for the next 10 years, but we're going much smaller, much more kind of like low key this year, building up as we go over the next 10 years and focusing more on other, you know, what we're trying to aim for organizationally is basically one large kind of like D2O advocacy event per year that can really move the needle on some of these conversations. So actually what we're planning to do this year is like this coming year in 2023 is focus all of our efforts on a 3-day network state, like an autonomous jurisdiction built in the middle of the Mediterranean. That will allow for individuals to try alternative forms of healing like psychedelic assisted therapy or other forms of healing that maybe aren't recognized currently by healthcare systems on the water. So kind of creating this like, 3-day network state in the middle of the Mediterranean and trying to, show people that we're currently in a really interesting position where people want these types of therapies, and the only way that they're able to get them is to start, you know, their own pseudo country in the middle of the Mediterranean to be able to access them and really try to lead the conversation in that way. So that's kind of what we're planning for 2023. Haven't really been talking too much to folks about it yet, but are basically putting all the logistics in place to see it through. So yeah.
Oh, sounds fascinating. I don't know if there's any relation here, but just something that just popped into my mind as we're talking about this, because we're talking about high finance, is I thought it was really fascinating. You know, one of the things I like to look for is like, where do psychedelics medicine like show up in popular culture in places that we might not expect to see them? And one of those surprising places was, I think it was two seasons ago on Billions, where Axelrod wanted to invest in an ayahuasca shaman. And then, you know, his competitor, I forget his competitor's name, but comes in and like swoops up the shaman. And so all the investment got lost. And I'm just curious, do you think maybe these kinds of conversations that are happening at Davos, is that then influencing the way that, that this is being depicted within media, like in shows such as like Billions? I'm just curious. I mean,
No, of course, of course. I mean, media is like all over this right now. There's like a funny Instagram account called Micropreneur, I think, where the person who leads the account kind of makes fun of, you know, all of these, you know, different almost cliches of, you know, psychedelic personalities in the psychedelic industry or ecosystem, whether that's on the advocacy side or the, you know, for-profit side. And so I think, yeah, 100%. I think that there's, you know, I personally wish, you know, I never really watched like too much of it, but I am aware of it, like Silicon Valley, like that TV show, like what Silicon Valley did for, you know, kind of the tech industry. I really wish that there was something like that for the psychedelic space as well, because it really is, you know, so many people with just such unique personalities kind of coming together and trying to figure out how to move forward with this in a way that is, aligned with everyone involved, or not. And so there's just so many fascinating things that are happening. But yeah, like cultural references to psychedelics have just, you know, boomed. And, you know, even 12 months ago, it's funny, like, or 18 months ago, maybe now, but like, you know, you could still run into a lot of people who haven't really, you know, heard too much about psychedelics, or they were just beginning to hear about it. And like today, it is really difficult to find people who are completely unaware of psychedelics. Like, it has really changed in the last 18 months in a very significant way. And yeah, it's just fascinating to kind of see how that's affected popular culture as well. And, you know, there's now like fashion lines and makeup lines and music all focused on like mushrooms and psychedelics and all of these things. And, you know, it's you know, just very fascinating to kind of see.
Yeah, I totally agree that, you know, I've been working in this area since, I guess, 2006 would be my debut when I published my first book, Mushroom Wisdom. And, you know, for many years, it was one of these things when people ask me like, oh, what do you do? It'd be like, well, I'm an author and I'm a podcaster. And, oh, what's your topic? Oh, well, you know, we talk about non-Nori states of consciousness or something like that. But these days, you know, I'll just say, oh, no, I'm into psychedelic medicine. And like, nobody bats an eye anymore. And it used to be kind of this thing that people would maybe giggle and laugh and say, oh, 60s. Like, no, I'm not from the 60s. You know, yeah. But the landscape has changed just so dramatically. I really think it's fascinating that people can, that they feel much more comfortable having these conversations. And I also do a lot of consultation work with people. And one of the things that I'm finding is both a lot of younger people who are interested in the therapeutic side because they're suffering from their own anxiety or depression, you know, they're not quote unquote druggies. And also there's a lot of people who are in their older years who are just looking at psychedelic therapy for the very first time, who have maybe never been involved with psychedelics throughout their 60 or 70 years, you know, however many decades they've had on the planet, but they're at a point where they're saying, hey, this sounds really promising. So I think that just the landscape has changed just 180 degrees.
100%, 100%. Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see like in 10 years of time what it's going to be. You know, it's like I've been telling my friends that are, you know, getting married right now and thinking about children. I'm like, you know, by the time that your kids are in their early 20s, right? So it's like 20, 25 years from now, I have absolutely no doubt that your children are going to be asking you for family therapy sessions with psychedelics involved. Yeah. Like that is very, very likely. And, you know, you can be as resistant to psychedelic medicine today as you want to be, but your kids are 100% going to be having these conversations with you. And, yeah, like it's just fascinating to see how it evolves. And, yeah, I'm sure there will be a lot of positives, a lot of negatives. We'll be fascinating regardless to see how things unfold. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, so we started it in 2020. 2020 was the first year, so this was our third year doing it. This year we hit more than 1 million viewers, which was super exciting. We've been using, instead of like digital kind of media of like the internet, we've been using actually television streaming. So the group that we worked with like had partnerships with Roku and Apple TV and Samsung, et cetera. And so we were basically streaming on TV, and that's how we were able to kind of get the numbers that we did. But really, the conference, I guess it actually has like a pretty fascinating backstory as well. There was in 2019, we knew that we were going to be doing this conference. And we thought it was going to be in person. And so we were actually looking for venues and stuff. And we had, around like several hundred thousand, maybe even close to 500,000 in commitments from individuals who wanted to fund this, like in-person conference. Because there, at that time, had not ever been a conference in the psychedelic space that actually had a business conversation relative to it. Every psychedelic conference that was happening was, talking about every other aspect of the psychedelics ecosystem, but not necessarily the for-profit piece. And that was something that we really wanted to have conversations on, not just, kind of like the opportunistic conversations of like, oh, there are these companies, but really like the very complex, the very complex consequences of a for-profit psychedelic industry and what happens and what we need to watch out for and what we need to build today to ensure a much safer psychedelic ecosystem for tomorrow. And so 2019, right before COVID, have 500,000 in commitments, and had a call with Liana Galuli, who worked for MAPS, and as someone who a lot of people know and love dearly for many of her contributions to the psychedelic ecosystem and what it is today. And she basically encouraged myself to cancel it. She said, you guys are going to be doing this conference in April, May. You shouldn't do this, because if you do this the wrong way, this is just going to be kind of like a trade show. It's going to be, a bunch of psychedelic companies that are paying to be heard and collecting investment. It's not going to be holistic. It's not going to have, all the stakeholders that are necessary to have a complex conversation. And kind of being from like the multi-stakeholder alignment mentality, for me, that was a really difficult thing to take, because it's like, okay, well, you have $500,000 of interest to be able to pull this thing off. You have a lot of people that you've been talking to about this, a lot of social capital that's gone into this. And you just have to tell everyone, like, hey, guess what? Like, we're not going to do this now, and we're going to do something different or whatever. And it was very good that I listened to that advice, because had I not, we would have found ourselves with, a venue in April of 2020 that no one could actually go visit because of COVID, and probably up to $1 million lost, and also a conference that would have been significantly worse quality. And so what we did is we paused things. We decided to, I think we did it in June of 2020. We took several more months. We really, surveyed a lot of people in regards to like what they wanted, what they needed, like really, again, took a multi-stakeholder approach. And had like more than 100 speakers. I think, I don't even remember how many days it was. I think it was like a week of like full-time content, basically all day. And the first time that we did it was literally like over Zoom. I like pinged every single person that I knew working in the psychedelic space in any capacity. And it was like therapists and journalists and doctors and indigenous community members and investors and entrepreneurs and like everyone. And basically was like, hey, listen, like, can you hop on Zoom for 30 minutes and have a conversation with this conference? And that's what we did. And we hit several thousand viewers that first year. There was just a lot of interest in something like that, and it ended up growing significantly every year after that. We had like a couple thousand the first year, 60,000 the next year, and then 1 million this year. So it just like absolutely exploded, and a lot of people are just interested in, I think a more nuanced and complex holistic approach to conversations around the psychedelic ecosystem. We're actually thinking about changing it significantly going into next year, and are having more conversations about what does it look like to broaden the conversations past psychedelics and really be, talking more about the future of preventative care, and not just kind of the psychedelic component, but what does it really mean to completely restructure our healthcare systems. And so that's kind of a process that we're going through today and figuring out what we'll do for 2023. But the in-person component was at Davos. And so we ran them in conjunction and had a few thousand in-person attendees at Davos this past year as we aired the conference as well.
Wow. Well, that's really amazing to hear about. And it just brings up another personal contrast for me. So I'll share with you that here in Ashland, I hosted a conference for 5 years that I held at Southern Oregon University. And the entire thing was done through donations made to my podcast here. And my budget was usually around $4,000 to $5,000 to do the whole thing. And, you know, with an audience of around 300, 400 people, something like that, and all just done in-house. We didn't stream it. You know, I would put the talks out later here on my podcast, but, you know, we weren't trying to do streaming and get people in from, you know, an audience all around the world. But that, for me, that's like the most money I've ever worked with for an event.
Yeah. No, 100%. And it's like completely different ball game. And, you know, like Davos, to pull off Davos for 5 days, it was $1 million project. It's a 5 days where $1 million goes into it. Now, you know, your audience is, you know, John Kerry and like, you know, dozens of the world's billionaires. It's like a very different game. You also have expectations of sponsors and, you know, not hurting those relationships and making sure that you're there. But it is, you know, Davos is, you know, possibly one of the most expensive places in the world to host an event, you know, $200,000 per day, basically. And, you know, you're getting quoted $100 per hot dog. Like, it's just absolutely insane because the types of people who are there are exorbitantly wealthy. And also the city of Davos makes most of its money during those 5 days. So everyone basically upcharges because they know that this community is going to spend. And so a lot of the revenue for the city comes from that event and keeps that city alive, which, you know, you could blame it on like, hey, these are like, you know, the wealthy billionaires that are, you know, making everything exorbitantly expensive. But it's also the city. The city knows that they're going to be able to get that money and they're feeding off of that and keeping themselves alive off of it. And so it's, you know, always a complex, like, you know, situation where, you know, of course, you know, $100 for a hot dog is just absolutely insane and completely eliminates the ability for most individuals to even attend a place like that. But that's why for us, like, it was such a priority for especially this first year to do this in a way that was multi-stakeholder alignment focused. Because, you know, when we got the opportunity for Davos, we knew that if there was any other venture firm that got this, if there was any other for-profit organization that got this, it would really just be the for-profit companies coming and sharing about what they had done. And for us, we just felt that that was so like unacceptable to how we see this space evolving and what we want to see in this space, that we just knew that we, you know, we literally paused operations of our fund for 9 months. We paused everything we were working on just to pull off Davos because we felt that this was that important to like do this at the highest quality in the most multi-stakeholder aligned way possible, because it was at such a high level, and to really show global stakeholders like what it meant to create a psychedelic ecosystem that is as complex as ours is. So yeah.
Well, it really does sound very admirable. It sounds like essentially you're the right person for the job. That just in this conversation here, that you clearly have awareness and understanding of all of these different components and these different voices and these different concerns. You're very holistically oriented. You're very forward thinking oriented. You're looking for solutions. And as you've even mentioned, that you're looking to branch out beyond just psychedelic healthcare to what are the other problems we can fix within the healthcare industry. So I think that it's really valuable. And I think it's really awesome that there are people like yourself and people like Tabula Rasa that are bringing this to these billionaires and these big money people who have the potential to invest in society in a way that could be really positive and transformative. So just thank you very much for, you know, taking that on and putting all the effort that it takes to and investment to make something like that happen.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. We're trying our best. You know, I think that like the ethos of our organization is just, you know, we want to be here 10 years of time from now, just surrounded by the greatest group of people possible and in community together. And, yeah, like for us, you know, that's such a core part of what drives us and, you know, our vision for the future. And that makes operating in this way easier, I think, than for a lot of other firms or groups that maybe don't have community as ingrained in what they're actually looking for themselves as they move forward. So yeah.
Okay. Well, I've definitely taken a bit of your time today, but I do want to kind of circle back around and sort of wrap up with going back to the Tabula Rasa website, which is tabularasa.ventures. You know, here at the top of the page, we have an email where you can submit, and then also the investor portal. So I'm just curious, you know, where it says investment in entrepreneurship. So for people who are interested in working in this area or investing in this area, how do they get involved and what are the opportunities there?
Yeah, so we've, at this moment in time, we're trying to, in the course of 2023, at some point, launch a startup school that is pretty much all digital, but is supportive of not just for-profit entities, but also nonprofit organizations, small businesses, et cetera, to make this ecosystem flourish. Those aren't necessarily companies that Tabula Rasa will be able to invest in, because again, venture requires very specific conditions of what types of things that they can invest in. But we are trying to open source as much of our own knowledge to be able to help people just build more effective organizations within this ecosystem. And so for folks who want to apply to either the startup school or the incubator, there's an incubator application on the site, I believe. So if you just browse around, you should be able to find it there. Yeah, feel free to reach out to me. It's just Marik@tabularasa.ventures. The tabularasa.ventures, I'm sure, will be in the comments of the podcast. So reach out anytime and happy to chat with folks. If I'm just too busy, trying to get things done, I get, you know, hundreds of emails a day. So if I don't respond, just, you know, try to reply again. I really love chatting with folks within the ecosystem and being as much of a help as I can be with kind of the chaotic life that I live these days. But feel free to get in touch and hopefully we get a chance to intersect.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and for your sharing today, Marik. And I guess I'll let you get back to those hundreds of emails.
Thank you so much, Martin. Really appreciate it.
All right.